the dead face of the sleeper. The woman had not died tranquil. Her features had settled into an expression closer to determination than the peace of the grave. When rigor mortis developed, would it develop in this parody of a world? The hole might harden further into despair. The chin was firm, the jaw stubborn in its lines, the nasofrontal angle of the nose barely present, with flared nostrils like a large cat's. It was the jaw, and something about the eyes and brows that kept distracting Harrow. Something grey protruded from beneath the flap of the orange collar, against the dead skin of the sleeper's throat. She crouched down and used one finger to hook it. It was a loop of thin chain. She tugged carefully, and the rest emerged. Plain metal links, unadorned except for a flat steel tag about the length of her thumb. She turned the tag over. The other side had been neatly etched with a single word. Awake. Reverend daughter, Nonius said courteously. She stood and turned back to him. The long dead ghost of her house still looked a mess. He had returned his rapier and dagger to their respective sheaths, but his face and throat were ghastly with drying blood streaked here and there with sweat. His dark eyes were bloodshot, his hair was matted, and his split lip was swelling up. He left sticky red footprints wherever he walked. He said, "Does aught of the foe yet remain? Are there enemies still who would hasten to harm you?"
"If there are, I don't know about them," she said. "Pent, can you sense anything left of the invasive presence?"
"Your soul is your own again, but the ghost will still, I suspect, have a corporeal foothold on the other side. Defeating it here will not have destroyed it there. The only sure way to banish a revenant is to destroy the physical anchor it inhabits before it can escape the shell. Inanimate objects can be destroyed, corpses too if you remove the brain. But Harrow, we have other problems on our hands," said Abigail. The sounds of the flesh strings hitting the floor had resolved into background noise. But now Canaan House rumbled again, not with any great ferociousness, but with a sort of timid, rattling unease, as though more of its facade was falling away. A sheet of dust fell from the ceiling, glittering softly in the white lights that winked off and on. The others looked up at the tumbling dust with varying shades of alarm, except for Abigail, who looked grimly expectant.
"Everyone listen. We don't have much time. The bubble is deforming," she said swiftly. "After multiple separate evolutions, there are too many places where it doesn't agree with itself."
Magnus said, "Another rearrangement? Will it cause a new scenario?"
"No," said his wife. "The memories have squared themselves away, and the intruder is gone. There is no more grit for the clam to worry into a pearl. And depending on what's happening outside with... all those external factors are driving the bubble to its natural end. We ghosts must head back to the river or risk getting absorbed or expelled by Harrow's soul."
Another low rumble from somewhere else, the far-off musical crash of some wall or partition slowly crumbling in on itself, a great particle mass sliding to a heap. Nonius said instantly, "If I have discharged my duty to you and my house, I am bound by another, a debt from of old that I would repay if I can. May I leave these halls with your blessing, my lady?"
Ortus said intently,
"A debt?"
"A dread beast haunts this course of the river, a king among monsters," he said. "A rival and ally is fighting against it alone, and I grudge him the glory of such an impossible combat. Free me to aid him."
A terrible conviction seized Harrow Hark's heart. She had been here for what seemed like such a long time that she had put to one side the pressing issues of now. The reality that was out there still, and the fact that she was still alive, despite her last coherent moments. a king among monsters in the river, and perhaps worse, the realization that she had lost a cherished and decade-long fight.
"You mean a lictor?" said Harrow. "You actually fought a lictor?"
"The third of the saints who serve as the hands of the Emperor Undying," he confirmed. "And then, in case she'd missed the point, the saint who is titled for duty."
"Why is he fighting alone?"
she demanded. A rising panic, strangely detached, was moving up the base of her spine.
"Where are Augustine and Mercy? Where's Ianthe?"
"I do not know these names. Even his own is beyond me. We met long ago, and I fought him," said Nonius. She very specifically did not look at Autus. He was being good enough not to say anything, but if he looked at her with anything close to smugness, she was going to kick his ankle. Another rumble from above, sounding much more insistent. Harrow said,
"But you're half dead already. The resurrection beast terrifies ghosts."
"I am not half dead," he said. "I am dead. Nothing more. But I am not afraid. This fight has sharpened my edge and awoken my senses. I am, if you like, warmed up, which, in context, I realize is not the best word choice."
Autus said, "I will go with you," and instantly Protesilaus said,
"So will I."
"Autus," said Harrowhark, "no, you have no idea what you're speaking of. The beast in the river is the soul of a dead planet come to destroy the Emperor. If there's only one lictor standing against it..." "He's dead," Nigenad.
She could not have said anything worse. His eyes shone as he said,
"I have lived so much of my life in fear, my Lady Harrowhark. I will not waste my death in it. I now find that I am no longer afraid of anything, of death, of laws, of monsters. I will advance before I can change my mind and become again a coward. Even if I cannot do anything more than watch, let me go."
In the face of her stupefaction, he added gently,
"What else is there for me, Harrow?"
And she knew that it was useless to hold him. Fearful, Autus had proved enormously stubborn. It was inevitable that he would be even worse in bravery. She did not know what to say. Should she thank him? Thank him now? Cordially request he not go and waste his ghostly adrenaline on a creature he could not hope to understand? But Pent, more tactfully, was already speaking. "I genuinely believe the river can be crossed, Nigenad. Come with me and Magnus. We could use your help in finding Jean-Marie and Isaac."
"If there is a way through, you will undoubtedly find it," he said calmly. "I am relieved that in my unworthy death I was able to meet you. I will still write the Pentiad. It may just have to be a shorter poem. Very short, if what Harrow says is right. My heart is set to go with the hero of my own house, and the hero of the Seventh."
"I shall be glad to stand beside you, Autus Nigenad. Never again will I doubt the will of the Ninth," said the unbelievably tedious hero of the Seventh, who then cleared his throat and said, "In the storm, the tree is glad of the root, not of the branch."
"Well expressed," said Autus.
"It's from a longer work of my own," admitted Protesilaus.
From behind them, Lieutenant Dias said, "I'm going too." They all turned to look at her. Her injured hand was stoically clutching her rapier. Harrow noticed that she had tied the hilt to her glove with a length of wire so that it could not fall out of her grip. She was bloody, smeared and untidy, but perfectly calm.
"I'm going," she repeated, and she shrugged. "Cohort rules."
"What cohort rule, Marta?" Abigail asked, bewildered.
"Chicken shits don't get beer," Dias said, and, after a pause, "might not be the official wording, but that's how I've always heard it."
Magnus said, more than slightly delighted,
"I have never heard that one."
"As it happens, I have," said Matthias Nonius.
They all looked to Harrow as though on fatal cue. Legends, soldiers, poets, Magnus.
Nonius, Nigenad, I cannot in good faith hold you, she said, finally. You have both served your house ably, and I thank you both.
Nonius, if you owe something to the saint of duty, he could probably use your help. Go now. I have to get back as soon as possible myself.
He stepped back and bowed to her. It was an unpretentious, entirely modest movement. In the Noniad, it might have taken half a page. There was no time for him to make any kind of speech. But despite over 12 books of Ortus celebrating his verbosity, he did not seem the type of man to make one. All he said was,
Many thanks and farewell. Spirit guide of the fifth, can you send us four to the shore's edge?
Easily, Abigail said. She stepped forward and put one hand on Protesilaus's and Ortus's shoulders, and she peered through her thick glasses at them and said quickly, Are you...
For the seventh, said Protesilaus.
For the second, said Marta.
For the ninth, said Ortus.
The candles flared up again, the black flame threatening to scorch the ceiling, and Canaan House seemed to rock again as though with some earthquake. The electric lights overhead flickered and died briefly, and all four cavaliers were gone, back into the river. Harrow found herself imagining them in her mind's eye, rising out of those turbid waters before the saint of duty with his spear and his sword, something looming behind him, bigger than the eye could comprehend, bluer than death, unimaginable, advancing to greet the four dead swordsmen and the lictor.
She had not said goodbye.
Harrow so rarely got to say goodbye. The lights flickered again. A fine haze was rising from the grill beneath their feet, carrying a thin suggestion of smoke. The candles had gone out entirely, and their thin, satiny souls were rising to heaven in the metal rafters. There was a pervasive, clinging smell of burning dust and the continuous rumbling of softly piling rock and bending metal. They stared at each other with a left-behind, exhausted bemusement. Harrowhark and the ghosts of Dulcinea Septimus, Magnus Quinn, and Abigail Pent. With rising agitation that she could not quite quell, Harrow found herself asking curtly,
What's my role in this exodus, Pent?
If you stay, there's no question of you absorbing yourself or expelling yourself, said Abigail, and there was something quite careful in the way she said it. You're the host soul, and can only be displaced willingly, or with the kind of violence the sleeper attempted. Spirits always wish to return to their bodies and pine without them. The only exits for you now are the river, leaving your body completely, or you can simply go home and wake up.
Gideon. It had bewildered her back at Canaan House, how the whole of her always seemed to come back to Gideon. For one brief and beautiful space of time she had welcomed it, that microcosm of eternity between forgiveness and the slow, uncomprehending agony of the fall. Gideon, rolling up her shirt sleeves, Gideon, dappled in shadow, breaking promises. One idiot with a sword and an asymmetrical smile had proved to be Harrow's end. Her apocalypse swifter than the death of the Emperor and the Sun with him. She could let herself go, or she could go back to her body and let her go. Nav had made it her decision when it came to imminent death either way. The free will to say, Harrow dies or Harrow lives. And she had said, albeit fuck her for saying it, Harrow lives, which required its opposite balance. Gideon dies. Now here she was back again with what she had always wanted. The choice to say yes and the choice to say no, with the needle of no sliding fatally back toward yes. She said, If I go back, it will finally destroy her soul.
It was Magnus who stepped forward and looked at Harrow face to face, and perhaps she felt that more keenly, that he was the man who had, in Gideon's own words a lifetime ago, been nice to her cavalier. His mouth was hard now, but his eyes were as kind as they had ever been, and kindness was a knife.
"This whole thing happened because you wouldn't face up to Gideon dying," he said,
which was a stab as precise as any Nonius had managed.
"I don't blame you, but where would you be right now if you'd said, 'She is dead?' You're keeping her things like a lover keeping old notes, but with her death, the stuff that made her Gideon was destroyed. That's how Lictorhood works, isn't it? She died. She can't come back, even if you keep her stuffed away in a drawer you can't look at. You're not waiting for her resurrection. You've made yourself her mausoleum."
His wife looked at Harrow's face and murmured, "Magnus, you've made your point." But he uncharacteristically ignored her.
"Do you know, Abigail broke up with me when we were 17. I kept a ripped-up corner of her dance card for 3 years. It didn't even have any writing on it, or her initials, or mine, just a ripped-up corner of card."
One of the lights detached from the ceiling above them with a trailing shower of sparks and shattered on the grill beneath. To Harrow it sounded like a tolling bell.
"This is your ripped-up corner of card," said Magnus. "You're a smart girl, Harrow Hark. You might turn some of that brain to the toughest lesson, that of grief."
The drizzling dust had become a blizzard, and something buckled against the whiteboard wall. If the destruction of Canaan House kept progressing at this rate, even if it was some kind of metaphorical shift, it would, in a very unmetaphorical sense, squash everyone flat. Rules were rules. If a chunk of her psychological landscape fell on Abigail or Dulcie or Magnus, it would be a second death. Their spirits would be erased from existence, never able even to enter the river. They clustered closer toward her, like plants sensing sunlight. As though she were the eye of the storm, the destruction seemed to revolve around her, and the ground beneath their feet was still. Harrow Hark found herself studying Dulcie's face. There was a strange, tucked-in stillness that made her old again, those fine sigil wrinkles on either side of the mouth that told her own lesson of suffering. Harrow said, "Then there is the river."
"The river means madness," said Abigail immediately. "You've never been there as an unanchored soul. You don't know what it's like. I haven't the faintest idea of what would happen to the secondary soul in a literal bond if the host soul abandons the body."
"You are alive, Harrow Hark. That does mean something where souls are concerned. Your soul longs for your body, and without something else to inhabit, I could not even promise that in your madness you wouldn't somehow find your way back, rendering all this moot." Even with her feelings schooled, Harrow's voice sounded feeble and childlike and plaintive.
"Is there nothing I can do before entering the river that might mean I stay put?"
"No," said Abigail. "It's the river. It moves. You have to pick the revenant's path and travel along a thanagetic link. And that's just madness again. Sitting inside, I don't know, a teapot, clinging on without sense or understanding, going slowly insane. And as I said, your soul longs for your body. What if you lose yourself to eventual madness and are reabsorbed, leading to some kind of mélange? You know what teacher was, a patchwork fusion between your soul and fragments of Gideon's. Harrow Hark, you stand before a known quantity and hideous unknowns. Don't walk back toward the unknown."
"If it were me," Magnus said, "I'd go home and live for her."
There was a terrific crash from out in the corridor, followed by a hideous creaking as, close by, a girder came down. The noise was awesome. It was as though the world were screaming and bending all about them.
The fifth house spirit caller lost her reserve and took Harrow's hands in her own and said, "I'm so sorry, Harrow. I wish it were different. I am so tremendously sorry." The ceiling above them buckled and shuddered, but held. Harrow looked at the stricken faces before her, at the now somber lines of the cavalier of the fifth, his jolly face achieving a certain supernatural dignity. His historian wife, a woman whom she now knew could never be properly avenged. The tragedy of the genius and the useless death, the irreparable loss to the universe. As though the universe could withstand more holes, as though the fabric of the universe had not become a series of lacework cutouts linked by the thin, snappable joins of those who remained. Could the pattern sustain itself with such absences? Could she, who had once thought herself well-versed in absence, endure alone? The answer was so obviously no. She was not even ready to have the question put to her. And yet, Harrow Hark said, "You've got to go before the roof comes down on you." Abigail gave a weary, rueful half-smile, a very fifth house embarrassment. "Not until you tell me what you're doing. In loco parentis, you see. I'm afraid I feel responsible for you, and need you to promise me you'll live." "Gideon decided that for me," said Harrow. She was not really afraid. It was only that her hands were, and were shaking independent of her feelings. The first falling chunk of ceiling landed with heavy, balletic stillness, causing them all to stumble from the shockwave. Abigail, Dulcie and Harrow momentarily cowered beneath the automatic and totally useless arm Magnus had thrown over them, a sort of optimistic human umbrella. Harrow Hark said briskly, "Pent, Quinn, Septimus, I'm poor with thanks and worse at goodbyes. Therefore, I won't bother with them." Magnus said, "Have you—" "Someday I'll die and get buried in the ground, and you can take it up with me then," said Harrow, and found, after all, that she was not really speaking to them. "Until then, I'm afraid that I have to live." "Then this is not goodbye," said Abigail, and she reached forward to brush a stray lock of hair behind Harrow Hark's ear, which was an instinct Harrow could not find it within herself to feel humiliated by. "I believe that we will see each other again," Magnus said quickly. "John said to tell Gideon hi, if you see her before we do. Don't try not to with any great hurry," said the fifth spirit caller. And then that same blue shimmer and they were gone, without fanfare, leaving her alone with Dulcinea Septimus. The soft ripples within the bubbles had not claimed the seventh. She stood there amid the falling dust and the noises of shrieking steel, her skin like thin, awful gossamer, and her short, sugar-brown curls stuck to her scalp with the ghost of sweat and blood. Harrow Hark, bewildered and stricken, drew closer to her as the world fell all around them.
"Whoops! It's me again, never doing what I'm told," said Dulcie. "One more moment, please."
Harrow said, curt with bemusement, "Hurry up and go. If I ever stand before Palamedes Sextus again, I have no desire to explain to him why I put Dulcinea Septimus back in danger."
"I'm going to risk staying here for a moment and getting squashed into nothingness instead, actually," she said. "The seventh says nothingness is the only truly beautiful thing anyway, so nya. Septimus, if this is about ensuring I get back into my body safely, you can trust me not to change my mind."
Dulcinea, with that strange face that was at once the twin to Kithareia's, and yet nothing like it, smiled an extraordinarily rueful little smile that never would have fit the lictor's face. She reached up and clasped one of Harrow's hands between her own as one of the corridors to their left came down completely.
"Actually, I've got something to tell you," she said.
Chapter 50. 30 minutes before the Emperor's murder.
The whole time Ianthe was leading me down those creepy, rainbow-swagged corridors, Harrow, I was wondering what the fuck had happened to you. I'd been pretty convinced that at any moment I'd find myself floating back down in the water, and there you'd be, ready to save my ass from shaking hands with the Emperor of the Nine Houses. I'd never wanted to meet God. Nobody ever met the Emperor in any of the comic books. God only ever appeared as a letter to somebody getting written out of the story because they had to go serve the Prince Undying. I was irrationally convinced that the act of seeing God, that was the end of the story. Space was being cleared for a new character. We stopped before a totally nondescript door, halfway open, and I mean nondescript. The doors to the rooms of the Emperor could have been mistaken for broom cupboards, and Ianthe stopped dead. I cottoned on. That door wasn't meant to be open. Ianthe pressed a finger to her lips and noiselessly pushed that door further open. We crept into a dimly lit and equally boring little foyer, with another half-open door on our left into a weirdly familiar sitting room. It nagged at the back of my brain. I knew you'd been there, but it was strange how some memories were like my own and some memories were whispers through a hole in the wall. Tridentarius pressed herself up against the wall next to the sitting room so she could see through the gap, and I did the same because, yes, okay, pretty curious. In the room was Kithareia. Kithareia's body, her back to us. She had been neatly tied to a chair with a band of angry-looking tendon. I couldn't see whoever was talking to her.
"Not a difficult question," someone said, without any particular concern. "It's not as though you have anything to hide. I just want to know how. Seriously, I'm more impressed than angry."
The voice was still gravel.
"I charge you with acts committed with intent to destroy, in whole or in part, the human race. Commander, for which the only sentence is death, repeated mass killings, the utter disintegration of institutions, political and social, languages, cultures, religions, all niceties and personal liberties of the nations by use of—"
"Commander, wake!" he said.
It sounded like he scrubbed a hand over his face. There was a muffled exhalation.
"I've heard this all before."
"Call me by my full name, or don't name me at all. I'll be damned if I pass up the chance to hear you speak the words."
The Emperor of the Nine Houses sighed.
"Commander, awake remembrance of these valiant dead," he said. "All of it." "I can't believe you feel you're in a position to demand things of me. All of it, Gaius."
There was the preparatory sound of indrawn breath.
"Awake remembrance of these valiant dead, Kia Hua, Kote, Pai, snap back to reality, whoops, there goes gravity," he recited, all in one breath. "Correct?"
"They're dead words. A human chain reaching back 10,000 years, said the corpse. "How did they feel?"
"Genuinely sad, bordering on very funny," said God. "Can we talk?"
There was silence in that room. The tangled dead hair was very still. He said,
"You've been trying to commit suicide by cop ever since I found you, Wake. I know when someone's trying to get me to do something, and you're acting like a woman who very much wants me to end her life."
"Telepathy," she said. "Did the 10 billion give you that, too?"
"Wish they had," said the Emperor. "Wake, you're acting like your mission's over and you want me to take you out of the equation."
Silence.
"What was the mission?"
Silence.
"How did it end? What were you trying to do?"
"I'm not going to talk to you."
"We both know that's not true."
A tiny ceramic clink. The Emperor was probably having tea. Ianthe stared into the middle distance, packing herself as tightly into the corner as possible. We shared the corner with a white robe on a hook, and she actually wormed herself behind the robe,
like we were playing hide and seek.
So I did too.
And had to watch whatever the fuck was going on through a thin veil of robe next to Ianthe, so please feel some sympathy for me here.
He said, Blood of Eden died with you, Wake. Any further action is just agonal breathing.
We both know that's not true.
You never would have fired nukes into my fleet.
Yeah, you know a hell of a lot about me, said the corpse. Perhaps almost as much as I know about you.
There's a lot I don't know about you, said God.
There was a brief flash of him moving through the robes. He had stood.
I caught an elbow and an arm holding a mug.
He was leaning against some chair a little way out of sight.
There's a lot I want to know. Why the ninth house all those years ago, Wake? There's nothing there.
She was silent. The arm gestured with the mug and he pressed.
It took Gideon, still weird, 2 whole years to track you down and kill you, even making you his mission in life you had plenty of time to do some damage. Why waste your shot on my smallest house? If you'd dropped in on the third, you could have done some real damage. And it wasn't by accident. You skipped the dummy target in the atmosphere. You found the exact coordinates for the house.
A longer silence, he suggested.
Do you want to talk about that?
Silence.
You've been a revenant for nearly 20 years, Wake. It's extraordinary. You really are everything they said you were.
Silence.
You're not a necromancer.
Necromancy is a disease you released, she said. Necromancy needs to be strategically and deliberately cleansed.
Don't spout bigotry, Commander. I won't kill you for it, and it hurts your cause, he said calmly. I have access to any number of cute pictures of necromantic toddlers with their first bone. They don't make for fat-cheeked roly-poly babies, but they've got a certain something, and nobody likes toddlers juxtaposed with cleansed.
How many babies died in the bomb, Gaius?
All of them, he said.
And after a moment, he resumed.
I'm not really interested in this particular game, Commander. Let's speed this up. You tell me the Thanagy link you rode to get here, because you certainly weren't in Kithereya's body back at Kanan House, and you tell me what you were doing at the Ninth House 19 years ago, and I'll put you back in the river where you belong. Who's there?
I thought we were rumbled until the outer door swung open wider, damn near squashing me and Ianthe behind it. There was movement past us, a swirl of white fabric, and the little clink of God putting his teacup down. Stuck in the coat rack behind the door, we were left with a view of 2 people in stained white robes, quietly facing where God must have been. It was the lictor who'd tried to kill you, and the lictor who'd been afraid of my face. Everyone was silent. The whole room held its breath. It must have only been a second or two before the Emperor said urgently,
Number 7.
Number 7 can eat us for all I care, said Mercy Morn.
Her voice was quiet, the untrembling calm of someone who had done all their trembling already.
It's over, John. It's all come out. It took 10,000 years, but it's all come out.
No response. Everyone in the room was still as a mock-up in a doll's house. Then he said, as though puzzled,
What's all come out?
I suppose it would be disappointing if you made a clean breast of it now, said the lictor called Augustine after a brief moment. But go on, try. Confess and be the man I want you to be, rather than the man you apparently are.
Look, I hate to be flip, said God, but am I in trouble?
The Saint of Joy sat down on the empty chair and burst into angry tears. She pressed her face into her hands and sobbed violently for something like 4 seconds, we're talking brief, and then she stood up again, having apparently gotten it out of her system.
Because this maybe isn't the time, he said, given that we've got company.
Again, thought we were rumbled. but he was just gesturing to the person in the body of Kithareya, still tied to the other chair. Both the lictors stared at her as though they hadn't even noticed her.
Mercymorn the First, Augustine the First, meet Commander Wake Me Up Inside, sincerest apologies if I got that wrong, said the Emperor. Wake, Mercy, Augustine.
Oh, we've met, said the corpse, with immense satisfaction.
Both Augustine and Mercy drew their rapiers with one long metal whisper. I couldn't see their faces. Next to me, I couldn't even hear Tridentarius breathe. Being lictors, maybe neither of us had to. I wasn't in a hurry to experiment. The voice from the other end of the room said, "Sheathe those." They didn't. Neither did they go for the shackled corpse. Wake. She had turned her head to look at them. There were petals in her hair. God said quietly, "You've met, Commander. Can you tell me more about that?"
"I met the woman. I never met the man. She was the spokesperson for both."
Mercy said, "It can't be. This can't be happening. This cannot be happening." And the other lictor said, "It evidently can." And God continued,
"In what context?" "They were working for me," said the dead commander.
Mercymorn demanded, "Are you flattering yourself or being wrong on purpose?"
The other lictor interrupted, "Joy."
But she was saying wildly,
"Oh, let it happen. If this is happening, let it happen. We had a deal, Wake. Where the hell have you been hiding for 19 years?
"Where you fucking left me," she ground out. "In my bones, then a blade, in that fucking hole."
Augustine said, "Mercy, don't waste your time. If this really is the lady in question, then Gideon has proved, yet again, that he is unfit for any job beyond making simple gruels and stews." The figure in the chair strained at her bonds with a sudden animated violence that made each rapier in each literal hand flinch. The corpse said, "You double-crossing bastards, you sent him after me.
You knew he was coming for you. You'd spent 2 years dodging him."
"You didn't say he was 48 hours away and knew my target."
"If you were on schedule, it wouldn't have mattered. You failed to kill him the first time. You were a whole day behind with the delivery." "Oh, and now I know why," Mercy cried out. "You broke with the plan, took things into your own hands."
"Necromantic wizarding fuck-up."
"So you did the worst thing you could possibly have done."
"I did what I had to do,"
bawled the figure in the chair. She sounded legitimately unhinged now. The mouth sounded gummy, as though fringed with flecks of spittle, but I was pretty sure corpses couldn't do saliva, so...
"I did what I had to do when the dummy ones died, even though you dried-up liches didn't give me the first fucking clue what I was really doing. Checking for life signs, retrieving a sample. If I'd known then what I know now, I would have just shelled the place."
"Now it comes out," said Mercy. "Now I am afraid it all comes out. You would have, wouldn't you? And when you swore that you'd help evacuate the houses, you never meant that either, did you?"
"Stop," said God quietly.
And everyone stopped. There was a flash of... I don't know what. If it was necromancy, it was of a kind I'd never felt before. It was too sudden, more taste than theorem. There was this citrus taste in your spit. Everyone shut the fuck up, which, as spells go, was probably pretty useful. He said,
"Wake."
"Yes."
She sounded irascibly eager, breathless to match her actual breathlessness. There were hard fuck-you edges to her voice.
"Will you answer my question now? Why did you go to the 9th house 19 years ago?
"To break into the tomb." There's an emotion that isn't fear, and I wish someone would come up with a word for it, Harrow, because right then I sure as hell didn't have one. It was this
sense that started in the balls of your feet and moved right up through your legs to your spine, and I felt it in your hands. I felt it on your tongue. I felt it go chattering up the back of your head. It made your scalp softly fuzz over with electricity. Maybe there is a word. Omen.
But you can't get into the tomb.
God sounded genuinely interested, but in this deeply casual way, as though he were hearing the result of a competition. It was the interest of someone at a party hearing the end of an anecdote.
Not without me.
The corpse was grim.
I came armed. It doesn't matter what you came armed with, Commander.
I had the baby, said Wake. The baby I'd had to incubate myself for 9 long fucking months when the fetal dummies these two gave me died.
Oh, God! It was yours, said Augustine in horror. I thought you'd used in vitro on one of Mercy's.
I said they all died, said Wake. The dummies died. The ova died. Only the sample was still active. No idea how, considering it was 12 weeks after the fact, but I wasn't about to look a gift horse in the mouth.
So you used it on yourself, said Augustine. Anything for the revolution, eh, Wake?
Are you judging me?
Only your intense self-delusion.
I always see the job through.
Wake sounded bored.
You sent me out there to kill a baby and open those doors. Whose baby didn't matter on my end. I carried that thing under my heart, threw up every morning that first trimester. Felt it kick. Had to induce labor and give birth in a shuttle alone, knowing by then that Gideon was catching up. Do you know, I gave that thing a nickname my whole pregnancy. I used to call it Bomb.
Anything could have happened then. 1,000 futures stretched out in front of me.
Okay, let's get this straight, God was saying. You brought a baby. A baby you'd made inside yourself. Well done. That's the classic. So you could, what, kill it and create a huge Thanagy cascade at the door.
I wish Harrowhark were here. It would do her good to know there are more people in the world with an imagination like her parents. But you're not a necromancer. You couldn't have manipulated the Thanagy burst. I mean, it's appalling, but it would never have worked.
While he was saying all this, someone else had stepped into the foyer. It was a man who looked like he had been stripped bloody by a wind machine and hadn't healed up all the way. A wiry, knuckled-up tendon of a man, with the face of someone who had been starved once and burned recently. Joining the growing line of antiques on board this place, there was a gun holstered at his hip, and at the other hip, a plain rapier with a basket hilt and a piece of fraying crimson ribbon tied to the pommel. His clothes were stained with green slime, and so was the scintillating white robe he wore, hood up over his head. He closed the door behind him and turned to look at Ianthe and me, with that weird, scratched-up face and those dark eyes, and I knew that we were now well and truly rumbled. He swept aside the robes. He looked at us, Harrow. Then he made this weird, half-grimacing, excuse me expression, and he reached forward. I was so far fucking gone that I didn't even flinch as he slipped the sunglasses off your nose. He slid them over his face, and then he let the robes drop back over me and Ianthe, and he walked straight into the shit show. Augustine lifted his head, and he said hoarsely, Gideon? The woman I was pretty sure was actually my mother, wearing the body of a woman I'd had a crush on, who in turn had been wearing the identity of a woman she'd murdered, until I fell on a spike so that my boss could kill her, craned her head around in her bonds.
Harrow, I will never forget the look on her face as long as I live, or as long as I die. For the first time she smiled, a small, dusty, crooked smile that was totally alien to Kitheraya's mouth, which had smiled at me often, but never like that.
it was the smile for your old cellmate who'd just landed back in prison, the one that told them at least you were in it together. Or more correctly, the smile of someone stepping out of jail after serving a very long sentence, having seen someone there waiting for her. Someone whose presence meant total reprieve. Someone she hadn't expected. It was a little bit mocking. It was deeply relieved. It was a smile that said, "You came back for me." The lictor who'd taken my shades pulled the gun out of his belt before anyone could stop him. He briskly closed the distance, pressed the barrel up to the base of Kitherea's skull, and he pulled the trigger. There was a wet sound. The body jerked and its head lolled out of sight. God exploded.
"Gideon!"
"Wake," said Gideon. "The second. First." As though that explained everything. There was movement. Then God said sadly,
"Damn it, Gideon. Her ghost's completely gone."
And Gideon said,
"Good."
Augustine said urgently, "Number 7.
Got away."
"What? What, it ran? You got it to run?" When this was not met with details, Augustine said, "But you lived?" Mercy Morn said,
"That's not important right now. I don't care about number 7. I want Gideon to hear this too. I want him to know what Pyrrha died for."
Now, finally, the Emperor came into view. He calmly sat down on the chair that Mercy had vacated, in front of the headshot corpse that was still tied up opposite. He looked like anybody. His hair was cut short, dark brown, with no different highlights in it. His face was long and square and ordinary, and his eyes were just absolutely, insanely fucked up. Deep black wells, this unreflective flat black. Even from where I was, I could see the white light that circled the irises, a cold flickering perimeter. At the moment, he had his chin rested on his balled together fists, his elbows set on his knees, and those whites had lighted on Mercy.
"I think you're skipping ahead in the story," said God. "I think you're glossing over a part. Because you think it doesn't matter? Are you embarrassed? Gideon, were you aware that when you let Commander Wake get as far as she did, to the House of the Ninth, to one of our own houses, our own people, that she was pregnant?"
A pause.
"I was aware," said Gideon, classic. "Why the hell did you not tell me?"
"Because I thought it was mine."
There was a rising call of dismay from that whole room, a sort of strangled
"Yuck!"
from Mercy Morn, and exhausted, was it a laugh from Augustine? Who was laughing in this eerie, humourless way, this huge, tired, exhausted laugh, until he had to press his face into his hand. Even then, he didn't quite stop. And Gideon Senior said,
"Forgive me, John. I didn't know anything about it."
Which I would have thought was a weird thing to say if I hadn't been too busy staring at Kitherea. The Emperor said,
"I've made mistakes too, Gideon, but you could have told me."
And Gideon Prime said,
"I didn't know to."
"How long had that been going on?"
"Nearly 2 years."
After a moment he added,
"It was complicated."
"I'll bet. So the plan was to kill a lictor's baby," said God, marvelling quietly. "A lictor's infant child, barely born, to start a thanagy cascade. It was a hell of a plan, but both of you knew it never could have worked. Surely you knew it couldn't have worked. Augustine, for fuck's sake, have a cigarette. You're getting hysterical."
The noise Augustine was making was nearly laughter. It was nearly not laughter at all. The saint of patience snapped in pure agitation.
"Stop kidding yourself, John!"
"Everyone's being very opaque today," said God. "You know we know how the blood ward works," said Mercy Morn.
She did not sound hysterical herself. She had swapped roles with Augustine unexpectedly, and now sounded measured and calm, merely dreamy.
"You never kept it secret from us. I always thought it was a little over the top, teacher. You were always so fussy about never bleeding. But Cassiopeia told me a very interesting thing about blood wards once. She always said that they should really be called cell wards, because they work off thalagetic enzymes, which can be spoofed with a substantial thanergy burst and the blood of a close relative, a parent, a child," the Emperor said, as though speaking to a kid. "And how would you ever—" and stopped. And he said, "Mercy." And he said, "Augustine." And he said, "Mercy." And then, "Augustine."
"I wouldn't think about the practicalities if I were you," said Augustine, extracting a cigarette. He tucked it into the side of his mouth. He was pretty good. His hands weren't even really shaking.
"It's not worth it."
"But it was only—"
"The once?"
"Yes. One evening planned down to the ground for 500 years, said the saint of patience. He lit the end of the cigarette. "Dios apiti major. We needed your, genetic material, and it was the only way. It was the first time Joy and I had been in the same place for 10 years. You were so damned careful, John. No vulnerabilities, no lapses. You'd have become paranoid if we'd gone a second round. Good Lord, it all sounds so coarse. I imagine I might be hurting your feelings. God, I hope so. Right now, I find I hope so tremendously. It's impossible. I won't believe this. How could you even—"
"Mercy, Morn," said Augustine matter-of-factly.
"I didn't even—"
"Mercy, Morn," repeated Augustine.
He took a drag from his cigarette and said, "Sorry, Gid. Didn't actually want you to know all the scummy details. Sig?"
"I'd kill for one," said Gideon, original flavour.
There was more silence in that room as the saint of patience lit another cigarette and passed it to the saint of duty. Kithere's empty corpse lay still and silent in its chair. The Emperor was staring at the crown of her head, probably where the bullet had exited, which I could not see. The other lictor leaned against the wall, staring into a shuttered window.
"So what?" said the Emperor. "Gideon, you tossed Wake out the airlock. She and the baby died en route?"
"No," said Mercy Morn thinly. "It didn't."
I pushed out of the robes.
Ianthe tried to reach me. I slapped her hand away. It was 7 steps out of that little foyer to the centre of the room where the Emperor sat.
I stood, breathing hard, my battered two-hander clutched in your hands, not knowing what to do with your arms and not knowing what to do with your face. There was this huge, insane roaring in your ears, like close-up electrical static, and it was like I was watching us move from outside, as though we were both out of the driver's seat, Nona Jesimus, and someone else was in there. But nobody else had their hands on the controls. It was just me.
Everyone turned to look at us. Nobody said a word. I stood behind the chair with the dead body in it, a dark hole at the back of its neck. The cigarettes made thin grey ghosts curl up toward the light.
I said. The world revolved. "I'm not fucking dead," I said. Which wasn't even true. And I was choking up. Everything I'd ever done. Everything I'd ever been through. And I was choking up.
And the Emperor of the Nine Houses, the Necrolord Prime, stood from his chair to look at you.
At me.
Looked at my face. Looked at your face. Looked at my eyes in your face. It took maybe 1,000,000 myriads. The static in your ears resolved into wordless screaming. His expression was just gently quizzical, mildly awed.
Hi, not fucking dead, he said. I'm Dad.
Chapter 51. When I was like 6 years old, I used to play a game, trying to pick out my mum's skeleton from the crowd. I'd choose a skeleton that I thought was her and hang out in the snow leek fields, watching them endlessly breaking rocks into gravel, watching them winnow through the mulch. I used to pretend that whatever construct I'd picked knew I was watching and would send me subtle messages. Hoe thrust into the ground 3 times in a row with a pause after, that was hello, because that wouldn't happen so often that it would beg a belief. When I was 7, the captain broke it to me that my mother wasn't even in rotation yet. She only got boiled and sent out when I was 8. Do you remember the time when we were little, and I told you to stop fucking picking on me, because what if my other mum or dad was, like, important? I remember. You said, what's the evidence? And I said, what's the not evidence? And you said, why would it matter anyway? And I said, why would it not matter anyway? And you said, I was an idiot, and we wailed on each other for a while. Then I said, what if someone came looking for me and said, it's me, the most important guy in the world. Here's the long-lost baby I was looking for. Everyone will stop treating her like shit henceforth. Also, I am going to murder everyone in here for what they have done, and Crux goes first. And you told me that if anyone came looking for me, you would get your parents to lock me in a closet and say that I had died of brain malfunction, which I now know isn't a real disease, so I bet you feel stupid now. You were furious. You said, it doesn't matter who they are. They're not important, and they're not coming for you. I used to sit by my mother's niche and catch her up on everything. Things like, Iglamine says I fixed my hand placement when I block and pivot from the lower left. Things like, Harrowhark was a giant bitch today. Told her that on the reg. Things like, I can do 96 sit-ups in 2 minutes now. Absolute 14-year-old bullshit. Serious A-grade drivel. It was worse when I was a kid. I remember the time you caught me telling her, I love you. And I can't even remember what you said, but I remember that I had you on your back. I put you straight on the fucking ground. I was always so much bigger and so much stronger. I got on top of you and choked you till your eyes bugged out. I told you that my mother had probably loved me a lot more than yours loved you. You clawed my face so bad that my blood ran down your hands. My face was under your fucking fingernails. When I let you go, you couldn't even stand. You just crawled away and threw up. Were you 10, Harrow? Was I 11? Was that the day you decided you wanted to die? You remember how the fuck-off great aunts always used to say, suffer and learn? If they were right, Nona Jesimus, how much more can we take until you and me achieve omniscience? And now we come to the heart of the matter, said the lictor you called Mercy Morn. She had stood up next to us, and God looked at me, and at her, and at me, and held my gaze. It was this that pinned us in place. When those white rings hovered on someone else, the blood rushed back to your brain. When they flickered back to me, I went white and blank again, mute and stupid, a floating outline. He looked at us, and he rubbed one of his temples as though he had a headache, and he said with an enormous sigh, Ah, the eyes. Yes, the eyes, she said. Your child, Electo's eyes. A ripple of ice over the face, a hardening of the mouth. He said quietly, Don't call her.
Electo, 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 repeated Mercy shrilly.
The other lictors flinched each time she said it, as though it were an oral stab.
John, you are trying to start a fight with me to get out of the fight I am trying to have with you, which is a painfully domestic tactic. Those are A.L.'s eyes, Lord, right there in your genetic code.
There could be any number of explanations, said God calmly.
Yes, said Augustine.
He tapped his cigarette out into the emptied cup of tea.
There could be. You've offered us explanations for everything over the years, but some of them didn't hold up on examination.
It was the power I could never get my head around, you know?
I follow power back to its source, John. It's the skill you asked me to perfect, and the longer I looked at yours, the less things added up.
This has been troubling you for a very long time, then, God said finally. A.L. always did bother you two the most. If I'm such a liar, why didn't I lie to you about her? I told you the truth about Annabelle's resurrection, and in the end you killed her for it.
My lord, said Augustine formally, you told us the truth about Annabelle, about Alecto, because she knew the truth about it too, and you never could control her. Even after 2 centuries, I'm not sure she ever managed to lie. That was what stayed my hand for such a long time. How would you have asked Alecto the First to lie? How would you have persuaded that mad monster into even an unsophisticated con? God said, don't call her that. A monster, John, Augustine barked. She was a bloody monster in a human suit. She was a monster the moment you resurrected her, and you went and made her worse.
There was silence in that room. The air had cooled somewhat, but it was still hot and sticky, and it smelled like everyone's sweat. It smelled like hot perfume and cigarettes and fear. After a moment in that silence, the Saint of Patience said,
Raise my voice. Apologies.
Don't worry about it, said God quietly. Mercy Morn was grinding her back molars, making a sound like ball bearings fed into an industrial mincer. She stopped and said pensively,
But you see, we all thought you were just sentimental over that horrible thing. Even though she was bad in every single way, we all hated her.
I didn't, said Gideon Zero.
Oh, do shut up, Gideon. Lord, you and she went through all the early days together. It made sense that you didn't want to kill her. We came to you back then. We came to you and begged you to get rid of her. We said she was too dangerous. We knew the beasts were coming, and we knew they were partly coming for her. She was going to get us all eaten alive.
Mercy's eyes had gone almost distant, as though she was living the argument over again.
So eventually you gave way. You killed her for us. But we never knew how you did it.
Annabel Lee was not the dying kind, said the Emperor. It might be more accurate to say that I switched her off.
You came to us and we asked, Is she dead? Said Mercy. And you said, As dead as I can make her. I remember, Lord, that you wept.
Well, I was very sad, said God reasonably.
Yes, you were,
cried Mercy, like this was welcome confirmation.
You were very sad, but you didn't blame us. You said you understood. You said you'd do what was right by your lictors. But you wanted to honour her, so you made her a tomb and set Anastasia to guard it. It all made such perfect sense for us. What didn't make sense was you.
God propped his chin in his hands again.
What about me? He said.
Mercy and Augustine both barked out hollow little sounds that were not in the same universe as laughs.
You don't get your power from Dominicus, said Augustine. It gets its power from you. There's no exchange involved, no symbiosis. You draw nothing from the system. It relies on you entirely, as we all know. You're God, John. But as the Edenites are fond of pointing out, you were once a man. So whither that transition? Where does your power come from? Even if the resurrection had been the greatest Thanagy bloom ever triggered, it would drain away over time. And then Mercy said to me, in a moment of true mercy vileness, she said, What is God afraid of?
those white-ringed eyes closed, and your heart almost relaxed in your chest. He said, a little irrelevantly, "Did you two just pretend to hate each other?"
"No," they said in dreary chorus, and Augustine said, "But we have never loathed each other so intensely that we couldn't work together. It kept us honest. I never wanted to believe anything Joy was saying. I never wanted to believe it when she said, 'What if he didn't really put down A.L.?' And then, 'What if he couldn't put down A.L.?'"
The eyes opened. They opened up on you and me. Those white rings like a migraine. Those black, iridescent insides like tar or a butterfly or obsidian glass. And he said, "Summarize, please. You both do tend to go overboard on the foreplay." Augustine said, "You didn't kill Alecto, and she wasn't just your bodyguard." Mercy Morn said,
"Alecto was your cavalier."
The Emperor didn't move. Augustine said,
"The eyes have it, John. Those damn golden eyes she always had, like a cat. When I saw young Harrowhark over there," he jerked his thumb in our direction, which still somehow had